today we have a great speaker. And I'm going to kind of start this off a little bit different way. If you were to go and find People Magazine in, I think it was November of 88, they had a list of the 25 most intriguing people in the world. On the list were then President-elect George Bush, boxer Mike Tyson, the first woman to lead an Islamic nation, Benazir Bhutto, actress Michelle Pfeiffer, Kevin Costner, Jodie Foster, theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking, actor Tom Hanks, Fergie the Duchess of York, pop singer Tracy Chapman, there are a whole bunch of others, and tonight's speaker. Quite an elite and an interesting list. Sage Volkman is our speaker tonight. She's someone who has an amazing story, which she will tell you. She grew up with her family in New Mexico. When she was just five, she was involved in a terrible accident, which I will leave for her to tell you about rather than me. She has grown up and obtained a bachelor's degree in psychology from BYU, Idaho. She went on to get a master's degree in counseling from the University of Phoenix, and she currently has a counseling practice. So it is a pleasure for me to introduce to you Sage Volkman. Thank you.
Thank you. What Martin forgot to mention about the People magazine is actually they were going to put Princess Diana in, but I beat her out. So just a little something extra. I am so happy to be here tonight. I actually spoke some years ago here and they invited me back. So I guess I wasn't too bad. But before I get into my story, I think it's important to know my background and to understand the turn of events that happened in my life to bring me to where I am right now. And part of that is my upbringing. My parents were actually crazy wild hippies. And my family grew up on a commune. The house that I lived in growing up was actually built by the guru of the time and the hippies of the commune area, and they would come and put in a skylight or a nail. And this house I lived in literally had like walls that went to nowhere because there was no foundation laid. It was awesome and crazy. And I was a very precocious kid, and I loved being dirty, and I loved just being out in the wilderness. My dad was a tree planter and my mom was a teacher. I always had questions. I always had questions. My parents, they were always answering them, and when they didn't know, they would say, well, let's find out. And one of the questions I started asking is, who's God and who's Jesus? And I started asking that when I was about 3 years old. Although near-death experiences, they're religious in nature. And rather than getting into the religious aspect, I really was curious about these entities and these deities and these beings. So my parents obviously were not religious because they were drinking and doing drugs at the time, decided, you know, maybe we should get some religion in our lives. They decided to just start going to all different churches. So I went to a Catholic church, a Lutheran church, a Methodist church. I went to a Buddhist temple. I went to some crazy church that had crystals. I don't know what it really was, but there was definitely a lot of gems involved. My parents just did this circuit of gathering all this information. So by the time I was 5 years old, I had this wealth of information about different kinds of religions and different kinds of things that were going on. And my parents decided on a church, and it was great because they stopped doing drugs, which was always a bonus in my life, is my parents that were actually there. It just started filling my mind with different things. And I was only five, but I just knew that some things were changing in our family. My parents decided to join this church. And 6 days after my parents were baptized, my dad and my brother and me and our family dog went camping. My mom had to work. We love camping, and we went fishing and So we took our trailer, and I just loved his island for the candy, really. But fishing equated to his food. And I loved it. So we went and we got our campground. It was wonderful. And my dad and my brother got up super early the next morning. And I stayed in the camper. And everyone knows don't wake Sage up before like 10 o'clock. It's probably not a good thing. So my dad would just check on me throughout the morning. I was okay. And about mid-morning, the dog started barking. And my brother turned around and saw that the camper I was in was just billowing with smoke and fire. And so he told my dad, and my dad ran up and tried to find me in that camper. And it was tiny. It was tiny. It wasn't a big one. He couldn't find me. There was just so much smoke and so much flame that he couldn't find me the first time. And so he went back outside the camper, and he was gathering his air and just breathing and gathering his wits, really, and trying to calm himself down. And he told me years later, he's like, sitting in that moment, Sage, I knew that if I didn't find you the second time, I would have to watch you die. And so he went back in, and he's like, I crawled really low, and he was able to find me. And the sleeping bag I was in had already completely melted to my skin, and I wasn't breathing. And so he pulled me out and began to resuscitate me. Finally, I let out a breath of air, and I started breathing. I was unconscious at this time. And I was rushed to the hospital, and my brother was rushed, and my dad was rushed. And we get there, and my dad has sustained some injuries and some burns to his hands and eyes. So he's rushed to surgery. And meanwhile, my mom is called at work. And she gets the like dreaded phone call that no parent ever wants to get, is there's been an accident. She finally makes it to the hospital, and she's like, Sage, I don't know how I made it. She's like, I was crying hysterically. And she gets to the hospital. She has no idea where her son is. She has no idea where her husband is. And they wheel me out on a gurney, and my body is so badly charred and so badly burned that they have to say, this is your daughter. They said, we're going to try and get Sage surgery, see if we can stabilize her, but I think it's best if you say goodbye. And so my mom had to say goodbye in a hospital hallway to a daughter she didn't even recognize. And so she's saying goodbye to me and praying and doing all those things a mom would do in that situation. I get rushed into surgery, and miraculously I made it through that first surgery. And they're like, Sage is in a coma. We have no idea she's ever going to come out of it. If she comes out of it, we have no idea the extent of brain damage she might have. We have no idea what her quality of life will be. We don't know if she's going to walk again. We don't know. And they said, but it would be really good if you guys decided to move down to Galveston, Texas, because they have a pediatric burn center. And so literally with the clothes on my mom's back, she just agreed. She said, okay, we'll go. And my dad was still having surgery on himself and getting his wounds taken care of and his burns taken care of. My mom said to my dad, you and Avery, as my brother, you and Avery stay here and you guys come down when you guys can. And so my mom went with me on the life flight helicopter down to Galveston, Texas, with no place to live. She just went. She's like telling me like years later, she's, oh my gosh, she's like, Sage, that helicopter ride was the worst ride in my life. She's like, it was so hot. And I was like, sorry, Mom, sorry to inconvenience you. My bad. She's like, oh, no, it's okay. You know, like, oh, I'm glad you're good now. So we get down there, and some of her hippie friends have caravanned out there and met her at the hospital. And I'm there, and I'm in a coma. And a little bit later, my dad and brother come, and my brother is experiencing that he's the minority now, and he's only 8 years old, and he starts breaking out in stress hives because he's so stressed out. And my dad is still having to have some surgeries here and there because he sustained deep second-degree burns on his hands and eyes. my mom, they're trying to figure out where to live, and they got someone donated a house and a car for my family, and all these wonderful things just started happening. Meanwhile, I was in a pretty unstable coma, and I was in a coma for 6 weeks down there. And during that coma and during that time, my family would get called out of a dead sleep. Sage has an ulcer, and there's a medication that's counteracting another medication. We don't think she's going to make it through the night. You better come say goodbye. This went on and on for 6 weeks. Sometimes it would be twice in a week. It was so unpredictable. Finally, towards the end of my 6 weeks, my coma started stabilizing a little bit more and a little bit more. Finally, I remember the day I woke up from my coma, and I was so groggy. My eyes were so groggy. You know, they put stuff in your eyes to like keep them moist while you're a vegetable, basically. I wake up and I like can barely see, and I see my mom, and you know, she's sitting there reading or doing her crosswords. I don't know, one of those things. And you know, I'm muttering, "Mom," and my voice is all croaky because I haven't talked for 6 weeks. And she's like, "Sage, you're awake." She's so dramatic. Like, she took drama, like, in college. So it's awesome. She's great. And she's like, "Sage, say something." And she, like, obviously wants, like, a five-year-old to be really profound at this moment. And I'm like, "I'm hungry." And she's like, "Okay, well, what do you want?" "I wanted shrimp. That's what I want." So just for future knowledge, if you're in a coma, sometimes you get shellfish cravings. I don't know. So I wanted shrimp. And she's like, "Okay, I don't think you can have that." But so then calls my dad and my brother come, and it's this joyous and joyful reunion, and we're just so happy. And I have no idea where I am. My dad starts explaining, "Sage, there's been an accident." He's like, "Sage, you were gone for 6 weeks, and I had no idea that time had passed." He said, "Where were you? Because you weren't here." I mean, he could tell from my body I was not there. This is my experience, and this is my sacred experience that happened to me, and what was happening in my coma and on my side of things during all that chaos was I was having a nightmare. And I was dreaming that I was just surrounded in this darkness. And I was so scared. And I remember that I was just, it felt like I was just in this pillar of darkness. And there was all these eyes looking at me. And they're just eyes, like sets of eyes. I remembered that the church we were in, they tell the children, you know, pray, pray. And so I prayed. I prayed and I said, "Heavenly Father, I'm so scared. Please help me." And that's all I said. The darkness became a gray, and the gray became even a lighter gray, and even a lighter gray. And then it started getting white, and then a brighter white. And then I was just surrounded and encompassed and enveloped in this bright white light. And it felt so good. And all those fears went away. And I could not feel pain. There was no hatred. I just felt joy. And I felt like I was home. Like when you return home and you smell a warm apple pie and you get that warm feeling all inside. It felt like that. And I just stood there and just basked in that happy, jubilant feeling. That's what it was. I just stood there. And all I could see, I just remember looking around, and all I could see was just white. And it felt so good. And it just went on forever, and I wasn't scared. It was just this happy, happy moment. I realized I was dressed in just, I don't know, they were just these white clothes. I can't really describe them. I stood there, and I don't know how long I stood there just soaking in that feeling and soaking in that happiness. And before me appeared two angels, and they were on a platform. And then all of a sudden some stairs appeared before them, and I climbed up and looked at these angels. They didn't say anything to me, and I thought it was really weird because I thought angels had wings. That's what I was born to, you know, believe, but they don't. And they're just dressed in these flowy white clothes, and they just stood there. And I just stood there on the platform, and they were facing the other way, and I was facing another way. And before me, another set of stairs appeared before me, and it led up to a throne. And the throne was huge. It was larger than life. And on that throne was what I believed to be Jesus Christ. And I went and I sat. I like climbed up him, and he was just huge and ginormous. And I climbed up on his lap, and I remember just sitting in his lap. He was like this hard, squishy material. I just remember sitting there, and I then began to have a conversation with him. Only it wasn't with my mouth, it wasn't with his mouth. It was with thoughts and feelings and emotions. And it was amazing because his thoughts were his thoughts and my thoughts were my thoughts. But we also shared a thought at the same time, and we were separate and one. And so it's really hard to describe, but the gist of the conversation was that I want to stay here. And I remember the first time he looked at me, and I saw his face. And I just remember his eyes were so piercing blue, and they were filled with such love. And he smiled with his eyes, and they were such kind eyes. And his face was just this sweet face. I remember him just looking at me and saying, and addressing me by name and saying, "Sage, I need you to go back." And I knew at that point that it was a choice. And I also knew at that point, whatever I chose, he would be okay with. It would be okay. It did not matter. He would not be disappointed either way. And I said, "Well, then I want to stay." And he said, "Sage, I really do need you to go back though." At that point, I said no at first, and then he asked again. And I sat there, and I still knew whatever I decided, there would be no judgment. And I knew at that moment that my body on earth was damaged, is the word that came to mind. I knew I was damaged, and I knew that if I decided to go back, the body I would be in would be in a lifetime of pain. There would be, I just knew there was just an obstacle after obstacle after obstacle, and that there would be pain. As soon as I knew that, I said, I said, "I can't." I said, I know my body is going to be, there's so much suffering. I said, "I know there's going to be so much pain. I don't know if I can." He looked at me, and he really locked my gaze, and he looked at me and said to me, "Sage, no matter what, I will always be there with you. Will you please go back?" And I sat there a moment, and I took in what he said, and I said, "Okay, I agreed." And I just saw his face just light up in delight and smile, and he gave me a hug, and he was that squishy, hard substance. And I just remember sitting there, and I saw him, and I looked in his eyes, and I could feel his love. And then I could feel the love that he had for everyone before me. And I could feel the love that he had for everyone after me. And I could feel that the love was separate and different from every single person. And I felt the uniqueness of his love for me. And I just remember him instilling that love. And then the next thing I knew, I woke up. I'm telling my parents this, and they were so awesome, because after I said that, my parents were like, "Wow, what an amazing experience." And they just really set that foundation that really did happen to me. It was real. And they didn't say, "Well, Sage, you were given a lot of drugs. You could be having, you know, some psychotic delusions here." They said, "Wow, what an amazing experience." And they really validated that did happen to me. So when I woke up, you know, and I'm telling them this, and they told me that great experience, they also started informing me of my lifetime, like what was going on. They said, "Sage, you've been burned 70% of your body with third and fourth degree burns." Fourth degree is all the way to the bone. They said, Sage, they've had to remove all your fingers, your ear, your nose, because the infection was too great and you would have died otherwise. Oh yeah, Sage, you can't walk. And I didn't know how to walk. Doctors told me I would never walk again because of my experience that I had and because of the connection I had. I knew I would walk again. That was one of the promises. And I said, yes, I will walk again. I had world-renowned doctors come and tell me and try and figure out what was going on with my legs, what was going on with my muscles. And they said, you will never walk again. And I said, oh, you're wrong, I'm sorry. And it was because of that experience, I had this bond and this connection. And I could feel that I would, and it happened. I was at my my brother's Thailand Derby. My mom was like the den mom, and she like parks me in like the front row, like I care. And I'm like, I'm 7 or 8 years old. I can't remember the exact time frame. Sitting there and I'm stewing and I'm all pissed off because I have to be here again. Like my brother's, I still remember it's this like putrid green car that he called the avocado, like I carry. I'm sitting there like stewing in my own juices that I have to be here. And because of that experience, it was like this quick connection. I just got this prompting. Basically, it was like, Sage, stand up. You can walk now. I really looked behind me because I thought someone said that and no one was there. So I was like, all right, I'll try it. And I stood up and I warned you, my mom was in drama for a long time. And she's like across the room. I'm like standing up and she's like, no, you know, all slow motion. Like she thinks I'm gonna fall and I'm like, I got it, mom, I got it. I stand up and I take my first steps all over again. And I remember that feeling. And the reason I remember that feeling is because it was such an intense feeling at that moment, like it was when I was where I was, surrounded by that bright white light. It was this intense feeling and this joy that was not earthly. And I could feel it and I felt so good. And I was so, so, so happy. And I took my steps and I walked and I walked and I walked. And you know, everyone at that Pinewood Derby witnessed a real miracle, and not the avocado winning, but me walking. Finally, I got to steal my brother's thunder. Through the years and through all the things I have, and through my experience, I have gained this love, this unconditional love for people. I don't even know some people. I'm like, I just love you. You're great. I sound like a total Looney Tune, you know? And they're like, okay, lady. But it's through this experience, I have this infusion and love for people, and I can't not help but see goodness in people. And it's like these rose-colored glasses that I have now, that I see people and all I can see is good. It's been a tough road getting there too, because right after I was burned and I had all these scars and these wounds, and they're open. And the main thing about burn survivors is infection. One of the things about having burns so severe and so encompassing in the body is that I had to have every day all the scabs that form have to be scrubbed off. It's the most painful experience of my entire life. When I was burned, they didn't believe children had the same pain receptors as adults. And so the only thing I got for my pain was liquid children's Tylenol. I was awake for it all, and I remember everything so vividly. And that's the pain I knew I would go through. I knew I would go through it. I knew I would have that insurmountable amount of pain that I did not know if I could get through one more second. But I chose to come back because I knew there was a reason, and because I knew there was a purpose far greater than myself. And so I decided, and I remembered that. And that experience has stayed with me my entire life, and it has edified me in ways that I never knew possible. And it has given me this great sense in life. I work with some really great coworkers, and I am always so positive. I've always had this positive outlook. I know it's through my rock star parents, but I also know it's because of this experience. my coworkers, I work in an all-male residential substance abuse facility. These guys come from jail and prison, and I have veterans as well. It's a tough facility, and there's some pretty dire cases. And I see nothing but hope for these men. And I will sit in our meetings, in our staff meetings that we have every day, and my coworkers are like, Sage, you poop rainbows. And I said, yes, I do. And the day I stop, we have a problem. And it's just because I see that. And I know it's not genetics. I know it's not because of my parents. I know it has to do with some of that. But mainly, I know it's because of that experience I had and the feelings I hold and the message that I interpreted from it. I have a great family, and they're so supportive of that experience, and they're so supportive of me now and still spreading this message about this experience, because what happened to me was just a message of hope. I'm grateful. It was a short time, and it felt like 30 seconds, that experience in my life, but it has altered my life, and it has brought me to where I am. And one story about me that, if Sandy was here, she would want me to tell, is just to show you how spirited and how positive I am. I don't know if some of you might be able to tell or not, but I don't really move my lips when I talk. And I was in elementary school, and my speech therapist came in and took me out of school, which I thought was cool because I didn't have to do schoolwork. I was like, awesome. She took me in, and she took me back to her office. She's like trying to teach me how to speak, basically, because I need to relearn everything because my mouth doesn't move. And she takes me, and she's like, Sage, move your mouth like this. And she's like showing me. And I was like, lady, if I could move my mouth like that, I wouldn't be here. I got kicked out of speech therapy. That lady doesn't know what she's talking about. I went and got my little Teddy Ruxpin and sat in the mirror, and I was like, you know, this lady has no idea what I'm capable of. I sat there and I pronounced through the alphabet, and you know, I was like, Peter Piper picked a pack of pickled peppers, trying to say and doing all these things and perfecting it because I knew I could do it. And really, that experience that I had, I could feel his faith in me. And I knew that he had just undeniable faith in what I could do, that the only person that would hold myself back in my life would be myself. That lady had no faith that I could do something another way. I had to learn how to write again. I had to learn how to do everything differently. And I love my little nubbies. You know, this is what I call my little nubbies. And I seriously, I can type like 45 words a minute pretty good. I know. And my clients, they cannot stand that I type faster than them. It's hilarious. Because I'll be like, this is not there. That's really my message of being here and that experience that I had. It gave me hope. And it gave me this true feeling of love and acceptance. And it was but a short moment, but like I said, it impacted my life. And thank you guys for letting me take up some of your time. And thanks.
I was just curious, what year was it that this accident happened?
It was 1986. I was 5 years old. I'm 30 now. It's so weird. I'm like another checkbox in life.
Well, thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you so much.
How many surgeries have you had?
78. Yeah. Yeah, I failed to mention that. Mostly skin grafts and reconstructive surgery. You know, they build me my nose and things like that. Still don't have an ear, but it's all good. I was completely actually bald on one side, and they were able to make me hair. And yeah.
The doctors have done a wonderful job.
Thank you.
Reconstruction.
Thank you. I think so too.
You said you had work or a reason or a mission. What do we all have that, or what specifically is yours, please?
I have no idea. I mean, I have no great answers in life. I think I have a mission. I'm still trying to figure out what that is. I think part of it's me pooping rainbows. Just being positive. I think there's, out of everything that's happened to me, and you guys, I've shared some of my life, and you can see, like, I have physical things that I have to deal with every, I do not go a day in my life without someone asking what has happened to me. There are certain things that I never escape, and I still believe there is a positive in every aspect, in every, you know, opportunity in life. I think that's part of it. And I think we all have missions, of course, here. I think we all are an intricate puzzle piece in life, and we all fit into someone else's puzzle, and we're here to help each other. I think that's what I think.
I'll jump in here before somebody else does. Okay. You mentioned at the beginning of your experience that you were in kind of a scary place with mm-hmm. people looking around. What do you think that meant? That's quite a different experience from the way most NDEs begin.
People have asked me that before, and I really have no idea. I don't know if it was spirits without bodies. I don't know if it was a purgatory. It was a scary, scary place, and that's all I really know. But I think it was a place I wasn't supposed to be.
I asked her if she still experiences pain.
I think pain is really relative. I think I experience pain, but I've gotten used to it. I had to make my nose, they had to get a piece of bone out of my hip. And so I'm like a little old man, and I'm like, when a storm's a brewing and like the temperature changes, my hip hurts. Oh, storm's a brewing. I don't know if that's normal, or I have minor aches and pains all the time, but they're so minor. I've had worse that I'm like, I can deal with that.
Obviously, you're an incredible person.
Thank you.
And you've done incredible things, and I'm twice your age, and I'd like to grow up and learn how to poop rainbows. But to relate to you, is there ever a day, a time when you want to kick a puppy? I mean, just once in a while? Because it's... You have such a positive outlook. It's, for me, who's incredibly human, it's hard to relate to you.
Well, I don't know if I ever want to kick a puppy. Sure, I have some downtime, but it's very fleeting. It's, for me in my life, I don't think it's beneficial or productive for me to wallow in my own self-pity. And I think it's very counterintuitive of what my deity and what my mission is here, and to indulge in that in long periods is nothing but detrimental and destructive.
I was going to say your mission right now is that what you're doing is sharing your story with us, and it is beautiful, and you're a beautiful person. I was just going to say, what is your happiness right now? What brings you happiness?
Oh, that's such a good question. What brings me happiness is, well, my spirituality, number one. I think that goes top tier in my life. And my family. I love my family. And I have, they live in New Mexico. And I have a niece and a nephew that is 5 and 2.5. And I just adore them. And they just adore me. And we're going to Disneyland for Thanksgiving. Pretty stoked about that. I mean, things like that bring me happiness. A good deal on shoes. That's good, too. Okay, hey.
Thanks for sharing your story. I believe I understand you to say that the being that you crawled into the lap of, that you believe was Jesus,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And during that interaction or with Jesus, that's mm-hmm. pretty amazing. I don't believe that I would question why I need to go back. If Jesus asked me to go back, but was there any thought of that?
Yeah, there was, but I think part of my experience, I chalk it up to being five years old when this happened. And so I think if he were to give me everything, it would just be just so above my comprehending. So I think he just baby steps. And
that's right. I wasn't thinking.
No, you're fine. No, you're fine. Absolutely.
I appreciate you being here. I've gained a lot. What would you say are a couple of your gifts or ultra perceptions that you might have now that you might not have had without your experience?
I think one is that love, that when I see someone, it's that just unconditional understanding of one, another human being. I really work with men that have killed people. I work with men that have been through hard places in their life, and I still just see them as a human being. Another thing is I carry a lot of static electricity. I have no idea what that's about, but I have crashed like 5 computers. I don't know about that. I would like to meet someone else that has had a near death. I hear they carry extra static. I don't know. It's the rainbows, right? It's like conducting electricity through the sky.
I have to say that I don't care how old I was. If Jesus asked me to come back, I'd probably ask him what he was smoking. You know, as far as that
yeah,
goes.
Yeah, true that.
I was in an automobile, motorcycle accident in 1990. Of course, I'm a lot older than you. Mm. And after 30 operations, I thought I was made of rubber. And I got to tell you that the way you're holding that special light is incredible, because I've not been able to do that.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
When bad things happen to you, I know some of what helps us stay positive is what we say to ourselves. So what do you say to yourself when bad things happen to you?
I say, what a great opportunity. I really do. I say, I really don't even look at them as bad things. I look at them as opportunities. And I might have a moment where it feels really crappy, and then I say, you know what? This is a great opportunity for me to learn how to work through this.
What took you into your profession, working with drug and alcohol? It's kind of fascinating to me.
I would have to say a simple twist of fate. I originally wanted to go into school to pre-med, and my parents said, why don't you take some psychology classes and see how you like that? And I was like, no, I don't. They're a bunch of quacks, you know? And we are. That's okay now. And I was like, okay, you know, and so I took it. And then I took one and fell in love and declared it my major. And really, it's just, I think it's how I got to where I am is through my higher power and through my spirituality and faith. I asked to be directed, and that's where I'm at, and that's where I'm supposed to be. And I keep leaning on direction and guidance. Just because that experience happened to me 25 years ago doesn't mean I don't still have a connection. I might not have that intense experience, but I still feel that, and I still feel guidance and direction and things I need to go and do. And that's where I'm supposed to be, and that's why I'm there.
Oh, it's just magical. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, my question is next. I'm curious to know, are you ever led to go visit other burn victims? Or is that just too freaky for you?
No, and actually, we're burn survivors. I always tell Sandy, we're burn survivors. Actually at the burn unit, I started a peer support program up there for other burn survivors and their families. And it's called SOAR, which stands for Survivors Offering Assistance in Recovery. And so, yeah, I think it's great. I love working with other burn survivors because we kind of speak the same language and there's some understanding. So, yeah, I like it.
I, I just wanted to tell you that we're really lucky to be able to hear you again. I was able to hear you speak the first time that you came, and so were my friends. And to see you again and be able to hear you again is so wonderful, because you left all of us with such a wonderful feeling the last time, and even greater this time. But I hope that you will come back again sometime and speak to us, because being able to come as a child's eyes, it's different than we hear all the time. And just to be able to listen to what you went through and how you survived and what you do now, it's a real privilege.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Thank you.
When you told your parents that you had sat on the lap of Jesus, they probably nodded their head. How long, do you have any idea how long it took them before they really, truly believed you?
Honestly, I think they did in that moment. They really did. The way I told it and the feeling they got when I said it was so earnest and so raw that they really did believe me in that moment. So, our parents, like, my parents are my best friends. You guys should meet them. You think I'm great. They're twice as great. Yeah, they did. Yeah.
I just, listening to you speak, your pronunciation is excellent.
Thank you.
And I was wondering, you talked about the speech therapist. Did you have someone help you, or did you teach yourself?
It's all self-taught.
It's incredible.
Thank you so much.
How old are your parents now, Sage?
They are 65 and 66. Yep.
I was just amazed at your speech.
Thank you.
You could have a job training ventriloquists.
I know. I totally need a ventriloquist. And like, I talked to my friend about it, and he's like, and then you need a ventriloquist doll that looks just like you. It would be awesome. I was like, oh yes, in my next life I'll be doing that.
Do you have any comments for us about prayer?
Oh, I couldn't even begin to say for you guys. I know for me, prayer is an essential part of my day, and it's an essential part of how I live my life and being positive. And one of the things I do in the morning, like right when I wake up, right when it's that foggy, fuzzy, and you're like, why is my alarm going off? It can't be that early. It can't be time. Right after that thought, I instantly say to myself, it's going to be a good day. And then I start with a prayer, and I end my day with a prayer.
Any practices for, is the connection strong enough that you don't have to practice to empower your continued connection and the presence for you?
Oh, I think I have to. No, I don't think it's a gift. I don't take it lightly. I think I have to practice just as hard as anyone else to maintain that connection.
Any tips or secrets?
I don't have any. I wish I did.
I was just wondering how your experience has impacted your family.
I can't speak for them, but if I dare to, I think it has impacted their lives forever as well. And my family has just followed their faith too, and they're still strong in practice, and it has really bonded our family and in a way that it can't ever be severed. And it's this great thing that it has solidified our family as a whole. So,
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask a question about your experience itself.
Okay.
If you compare the time that you actually were experiencing your near-death experience, time you were out of your physical body, mm-hmm. how would you describe how real that was compared with how real a dream seems, how real everyday life seems, how real maybe special event in your life seems,
right.
so people right. can understand the relative qualities of those.
Right. It was as real as this moment we're having together. Recalling it and the recollection of it is like recalling a memory, like a real recent memory. It's very real. It's not like a dream because there's so much of what the senses going on. They're so vivid and it's not this like dreams. There's this weird jump and everyone says, I had a weird dream last night. No one says, I had a dream that made total sense last night. And so it wasn't, you know, like no one says that. It's because dreams are so choppy and it's just these random neurons firing. My experience had an account. It had a beginning and an end. It had details. My senses were invoked. It was a memory, and it really did happen. That's exactly how it feels.
Kind of a weird question, but what advice would you give to all of us crybabies?
Could you elaborate a little more on the crybaby part?
Well, if things happen to me and I go, oh, boo-hoo, mm-hmm. my life is really tough. Mm-hmm. What am I going to do kind of
right.
thing. And I have it so hard.
Right.
The stories that you tell yourself, or at least I tell myself.
Right.
And you've had how many surgeries?
78.
Okay, 78 surgeries. I've had a couple.
Uh-huh.
Nothing.
That's okay. A couple nothing. Still painful.
I think that we tend to forget how good we have it. And so as a result, we cry right. in our... So what advice would you give to me as a crybaby? What would you say to me?
Man, that's a tough one. I think for me and how I get through things, and I know you want advice for yourself, but I don't know if this will work for you. I know it works for me. And part of it is my brother bought me this book. It's called The Book of Questions. I absolutely love it. And it's these rhetorical questions. And one of them is, if life is hard, what are you comparing it to? And I just ask myself things like that. And there's another one in it, in that book, that's, would you know how brave you are if life was easy? And I ponder things like that because I wouldn't know how brave, I wouldn't know how courageous I am if I had such an easy life. I have moments where I'm down. My parents are on a mission in the Caribbean right now, and I haven't. This will be the first time in 30 years that I won't go home for Christmas or for Thanksgiving. It's really hard. And when I talked to them for the first time when they got to the Caribbean, I just cried. I felt sorry and I was sad and I was happy and joyous. But most of all, I was like, okay, it's okay to be sad in this moment. But it's not going to carry on, and I can be happy now. I think what I realize in my life is it's just choices. I have choices. I have, like, undiagnosed road rage. I really do, like Utah. Oh, my gosh. And I get this, like this crazy look on my face during rush hour, and I'm like, Sage, these people aren't out to get me. Sage, calm down. It's really these choices that I make moment to moment sometimes that I don't need to be angry. I don't need to be sad. And what would I like to be right now? And then I follow that thinking.
Okay, here's the way I see this.
Okay.
You've been through a lot. And you are so amazingly normal.
I know. I fooled you all.
I mean, I'm listening to you, and it's like, oh, you're going, so what else is new?
Yeah.
And you're just this normal person, and you've been through hell.
I've been through hell and back, for sure.
And you don't even strike me as even a little bitter or angry about it.
No. And I didn't realize I had a choice to be bitter or angry until much later in life when I realized I already made the choice not to be bitter and angry.
So you maybe being 5 years old, you really didn't know the difference. Well, you did, but it didn't strike you as anything.
I've seen other 5-year-olds throw fits that are burn survivors, and other ones that this isn't fair. I don't want this. I just didn't have that. I just didn't know that was an option. And then when I did, I said, oh, well, I've made it this far. Well, it's a few more years.
Well, I, for one, want to congratulate you on just being an amazing woman.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
You said that you were in a coma for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And that your experience was pretty short. Do you know where you were the rest of the time?
I think I was there the whole time. I think time is different up there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So for 6 weeks, you got to be up there.
Yeah.
That's very nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Sage, thank you so much for coming. If anyone else has a